Our topic this evening I've titled Cosmos and Contact, the religion of Carl Sagan. Cosmos, as you perhaps are aware, is the title of a PBS series that Carl Sagan did in the early 70s, and a book was spun off of that. That series has been shown and reshown again and again in the 25, 30 years since that first came out. And then Contact is, I think, Sagan's only shot at a science fiction novel, written perhaps 10, 15 years ago, and just recently produced as a film, which has now made it out to the video market. And we're going to be looking at about a 15-minute clip of that further on in our discussion this evening. I've subtitled the talk, The Religion of Carl Sagan, and some might wonder, was he really religious? Well, that's going to depend a little bit on how you define religious. Let's see what I can do to get my machinery working here. There we go. Whoop. All right. Well, we jumped past one, and I don't even know how to get back to it. So let's see if there's a way to get back here. The response on this is not too great. I may have to tell you what it said. In the previous slide, we had the opening statement from Cosmos, and very familiar statement by Sagan, the cosmos is all it is, or ever was, or ever will be. And when I first read that, I asked myself, is that a scientific statement? Is that a theological statement? And I thought about that a little. I decided that Carl Sagan's TV series Cosmos, and its a spin-off book, is really a series of evangelistic sermons. And if you don't recognize the religion, it's perhaps because you either don't think of that as a religion or something of that sort. What is religion? Our dictionaries rather typically suggest something like this, a belief in a divine or supernatural power or powers to be obeyed and worshipped as the creator of creators and ruler of rulers of the universe. And we probably would say Sagan does not have a religion by that particular definition. So we move down to definition two. An expression of this belief in conduct or ritual. Well, that doesn't sound like, since he didn't have that belief, he can't very well express it in conduct or ritual. That doesn't sound much like it either. Now, however, the third one here gets a little closer. Any specific system of belief, worship, conduct, etc., and I think that's a belief or worship or conduct or such, often involving a code of ethics and a philosophy. And I think it's fair to say that Sagan does have something of that sort. Besides, a number of people realize that religion can be defined somewhat more broadly than we typically do. Roy Clouser, a professor of philosophy at Rutgers University, in his book The Myth of Religious Neutrality, makes a stab at a definition of religion. A religious belief is any belief in something or other as divine. You say, does Carl Sagan believe in something or other as divine? Well, we'd probably be inclined to say no with our typical definitions of divine, but Clouser goes on to say, divine means having the status of not depending on anything else. A divine means something like self-existent. And if we define it that way, then Sagan does appear to have religious beliefs. He believes that the cosmos is all that is, or was, or ever will be. And so he is assigning something like divinity to the cosmos. So, does Carl Sagan have a religion in this sense? Yes, I believe he does. And we want to talk a little bit about that this evening. We're not actually going to spend all of our time talking about the various peculiarities of Sagan's own view, but we want to think through, bouncing off of where Sagan is coming from, the whole question of worldviews and what are our basic beliefs and why do we believe those basic beliefs? Do we have warrant for those basic beliefs? In Sagan's book, Cosmos, on page 246, he says this about the universe that certainly seems to suggest that he believes that that's all there is. In that titanic cosmic explosion, the universe began an expansion which has never ceased. It is misleading to describe the expansion of the universe as a sort of distending bubble viewed from the outside. By definition, nothing we can ever know about was outside. Now, Sagan seems to be saying there isn't any outside to the cosmos. The cosmos is all it is, or was or ever will be. I had an opportunity, it's been probably 15 years ago now, to speak at Cornell on Carl Sagan and on Sagan's Cosmos. He did not come, but his one of his writers was there, and the chairman of the astronomy department was there. And the writer tried to argue that Sagan wasn't saying that there was no God, but that Sagan was saying that we define the cosmos as all there is. That's a definition of cosmos. And so if there's a God, he's part of the cosmos. I was frankly skeptical about that particular spin on the matter, but that's what at least this particular co-writer of Sagan's had to say. Sagan certainly is not big on the idea that that the existence of God is a viable option or an option that he feels that one should go with, certainly reluctant to allow the idea of God as some kind of a help in our understanding of the universe. In page 257 of his book, Cosmos, he says, in many cultures, it's customary to answer that God created the universe out of nothing. But this is mere temporizing. If we decide where God comes from to be unanswerable, why not save a step and decide that the origin of the universe is an unanswerable question? Or if we say that God has always existed, why not save a step and conclude that the universe has always existed? I will say a few things about that particular remark tonight, but most of my fire in that direction will be saved for tomorrow night when we talk about the cosmos in the Bible and look at some evidence regarding the nature of the cosmos and various models to try and explain its basic structure and such. Sagan here seems to be saying that a God is pretty far down the list in what we would consider as options for trying to explain reality. Sagan's last written book, to my knowledge, unless there's something that is still being prepared for the press now, Sagan passed away late in 97, is his work called The Demon-Haunted World. And we probably get a better picture of Sagan's mature methodology of finding knowledge of epistemology in that particular work. Sagan, in this work, is very clearly concerned about the rise of what he considers superstitions. And in that class, he puts New Age philosophies, belief in UFOs, belief in the supernatural. And yet, Sagan wants to be open to nature. He wants to be willing to go where the evidence of nature points, as it would seem to him. At least in this book, he is not in principle ruling out the supernatural. You kind of get the impression that he's trying pretty hard in Cosmos, and he certainly has lots of negative things to say about people who believe in the supernatural or that sort of thing, even in the demon-haunted world. However, his position here in this work is that he is not impressed by the evidence for the supernatural he has seen. So that, I think, is kind of where we're going to be coming from and what we're going to be thinking about this evening. Openness to nature. If you're open to nature, if you do not in principle rule out the supernatural, what do things really look like? Now, Sagan does not claim that he's got the answer to everything. He admits that there are unsolved problems in nature. For instance, the origin of life, he admits, is an unsolved problem. Page 39 of Cosmos, he says, there's still much to be understood about the origin of life, and that, I think, is even an understatement. And then finishes up that sentence with, including the origin of the genetic code. Well, what sort of thing does he have in mind there? Carl Sagan wrote the article Life that appeared in two editions of the Encyclopedia Britannica, the 70 edition and the one that followed that. I don't recall just what the date on that was. And so if you look in his article Life in those editions, the Encyclopedia Britannica, he makes this remark, which obviously would have to be dealt with in some way in answering the question of what is the origin of the genetic code. He tries to explain the complexity of one of the simplest forms of bacteria that we know about, E. coli, and he says the information content of a simple cell, such as E. coli, has been estimated as around 10 to the 12th power bits, using computer terminology. And then for those who aren't into computer terminology, comparable to about 100 million pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica. So here we have one of the simplest living things, There's arguments about whether you can count viruses as simpler living things because they depend upon more complicated living things to function. But a E. coli can, still got to have stuff to eat off of and that sort of thing, but pretty simple, and yet 100 million pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica is necessary, would be necessary to encode the DNA of the E. coli. Well, we move over from Cosmos to think a little bit about the book Contact. How many have read the book Contact here at this point? Okay, probably half a dozen or so. How many have seen the film Contact? Ah! We can see that this is the visual age, if you like. And I'm going to be playing a little bit on some differences between the film Contact and the book Contact. But both of them are interested in this question of how would you recognize a intelligent message that came to us from beyond, an ET message, we might say. And Sagan sketches it like this. We ought to have a strong signal. And in the film and book Contact, they have a signal that cannot be missed by the radio telescopes of the world. And so after it's first been discovered, you have hundreds of radio telescopes all over the world listening to this powerful signal. And then it has some kind of an unmistakable sign that it is a intelligent message of some sort. And the technique that Sagan sets up in this, he wrote the book and obviously advised for the film. He didn't probably have the last word on everything that was done in the film. But if in the front of the message, you have a few dozen of the prime numbers, the numbers that are only divisible by themselves, and one. They cannot be factored into smaller numbers. Those things don't occur out there in nature, and therefore that would be decisive that you're getting some kind of signal of that sort. And then in the actual story, if you remember that, there's this long message that comes, and after they get through the shock of seeing the Hitler opening the Olympic Games and such, they finally begin to see that there's another complicated message of some sort there that finally runs to about 50,000 pages, and it's the instructions for building a transport machine. In the book, it's a transport machine for, as I recall, 5 individuals. In the film, that's simplified down to a transport machine for 1 individual. Well, let's see if we can make all this stuff happen here. We're going to try and go back to that, maybe, and go back to this, maybe, and play. And let's see what happens. LA Airway is on Vega, not on the star, something around it, and is about to have a surprise extraterrestrial visitor. Yes, sir, over here. Okay, if I try to reconstruct your question, I think you're saying if God is as active as, let's say, Christianity says he is, why don't we see more evidence of it or something of that sort? Yeah. Well, I think there's experience of many people who have turned their lives over to God and have had rather striking things happen in that direction. And yet there's a complication there as well. And that is God, on the one hand, has chosen to give us evidence that he exists, but on the other hand, he has chosen to hide himself to a certain extent because he has a purpose for our life. Many people raise the question of, if God is like what the Bible says, why does all this evil take place in the world, etc.? And I'm not sure I can give you a complete answer on that sort of thing, but I can point you in the direction of a couple of things that are related to that. And those have to do with the question of, what is God's intention for the world? What is he trying to do? What is he trying to do with our lives? We would say, if God's intention is to be a hotel keeper, then I've got a lot of complaints. Okay? I paid my $79 for this room, and I expect to have clean sheets and all of that sort of thing. But maybe not God. Maybe God's not a hotel keeper. Maybe God's a novelist. A good novelist can have some bad characters in that novel. And the novel is trying to tell us something
about the interaction of those characters and about the consequences of choices they make. And I think God has opened up that kind of a space in the universe. And yet, somehow, without himself giving up control of the universe. And I can't give you the mechanism on that. Okay? So I don't think I can solve your problem in that direction. But I suggest, and we're going to look a little bit at some stuff on fulfilled predictions on Sunday morning, that there's evidence that God has revealed in advance some of the things he's going to do, and we've seen them strikingly fulfilled. There are, of course, things that he's revealed that haven't happened yet, some of which, when they do happen, that will be it. That's the end, if you like. So that's about what I can do for you at this point. So thank you. Good question. Try another question here. Yes, sir, right here. That's a mixed statement, actually. He would certainly suggest that mutations are not directed, okay? So they're happening by chance. He certainly would not suggest that there are no laws in the universe, that there's no no ways in which various kinds of molecules interact. There's no, you know, that there's no regularity regarding how things diffuse in liquid or something of that sort, or how energy. So I think Hoyle knew that. I know that. Okay, I'm not trying to mislead anybody in the audience. This is not my talk on evolution, so we didn't go into those sorts of things. I would say on the evolutionary question, I have these problems. Other people have different kind of problems. I have a problem regarding the origin of life, and we will deal a little bit with that on Saturday morning when we look at computer viruses, artificial life, and the origin of life. Question of how much complexity do you need for a simplest self-reproducing automaton, which is some kind of a base definition of what something is that is living. And so we're going to try and look a little bit at that. That's the origin question. The question I think that that people would perhaps have more familiarity with is regards, can you get the diversity and complexity of living things we've got now if you had, say, a simplest prokaryotic life or something at 3.8, 3.9 billion years ago? Do you have enough time in one planet to expect to produce that sort of thing? And would it leave the kind of markers it has left in the fossil record if that is indeed what has happened? The thing that strikes me as the biggest stumbling block there is the question, actually two of them, the question of irreducible complexity dealt with by Michael Behe in his book Darwin's Black Box. And the other one is the question of transitional fossils in the fossil record, not the question of whether there aren't any transitions or not. There may be some. The question is, are there anything like the number of transitions there ought to be if the movement from one living thing to another living thing is by a random walk? A random walk ought to leave behind debris of billions and billions of intermediates. And we have got in our not display cases, the storage cases, I suppose, of fossils in our museums, we've probably got something like 200,000 to a quarter billion fossils, and yet those ought to be almost all transitions, if indeed random walk is the procedure by which you're getting from one another. So that's the direction I go. Now, we zapped through that rather quickly. Follow-up question. No, I know. He has a directionless. Of course, that's all the more random than guys who think that it progresses the other way. I think their view basically is it's a diffusion. Okay, as I heard a rehash of his talk, I wasn't here. It's basically you've got a wall over here of zero complexity. You can't go on the other side of that, and so the diffusion has to go this way away from it. But have to, and whether it'll actually go any distance is two very different questions. And that, I think, is the one that Gould and Dawkins and others keep regularly finessing, is whether you can really expect to build up the complex multi-part structures that we've actually got, many of which apparently won't work at all if one thing is wrong, and to work your way into that. They've actually got to assume that the phase space to get from the simple things to the complicated things has got pathways, for the neo-Darwinists with no jumps, and for Gould with moderate jumps. He didn't want very big jumps. He didn't want to get classed as Goldschmidt. With small jumps, that all of which are functional and viable, are inviable in the sense of being able to compete with their competitors to compete with. So, yeah. Okay, further questions? Yes, here, ma'am. Or music, not sure which it comes from. what are these basic forces? Well, one of them is the one that holds nuclei together inside an atom, holds the various pieces of the nuclei together, the protons and the neutrons together. We call it the strong nuclear force. We now know it as something like the leftover remnants of the interactions between quarks, or at least that's the current model on what it is. And we will assign it a strength 1 to compare with the other three forces we're going to be looking at. Strong nuclear force is what holds the neutrons and protons, say, in oxygen together, which in that case would typically be 6 protons and 6 neutrons together. It has to overcome rather strong repulsive force among the protons. Electromagnetism is a much weaker force, roughly 1/100th the size of the other, and that is the force that is involved in light and light transmission. It's the force that's involved in the structure of solids. The fact that you are sitting on a seat and not going through it is due to the fact that the electromagnetic force can be repulsive under certain circumstances. And the fact that the seat is not falling apart is also because the electromagnetic force is cohesive as well. It's got a mixture of positive and negative charges, and the dissimilar forces attract each other. A positive attracts a negative, but the similar forces, the similar charges, positive repulse, negative repulse. So you get that kind of an effect. The strength of the strong nuclear force are rather substantial, but very short range. Typically, the size of a nucleus is around the range of a strong nuclear force. Electromagnetism is viewed in some circles as having what we might call an infinite force range. It actually inversely square force range, but it doesn't have a sharp cutoff anywhere. The third force is probably the least familiar of the four forces, the weak nuclear force, and we'll just say it's related to holding neutrons together, though other things could be said about it. And notice its strength relative to the strong force is down by 100,000 or down by 1,000 from the electromagnetic force, and it has an even shorter force range than the strong nuclear force does. Lastly, we have gravity, which is what is seems to be the dominant force at planetary sizes and larger, and even typically, a dominant force, a kind of a balanced force at our size scales, I guess. We're sort of in an interaction range between gravity and electromagnetism. But very weak, very weak. Strength 1 over 10 to the 39th power against the strong nuclear force. Enormously weak force. But unlike electromagnetism, you don't have any antiparticles that have anti-gravity. And also another feature that is different about the gravitational force. Massive objects only attract each other, whereas two positive charges repulse each other, two negative charges repulse each other. So you've got a dissimilarity in that area as well. As divergent in size as these four forces are, very slight changes in the values of any of these would be disastrous for a functional universe and certainly for a universe with life in it. Take a look at the strong force, for instance. If the strong force were only 50% weaker, that wouldn't make much difference relative to the electromagnetic force or the weak interaction or the gravitational force. There wouldn't be any stable elements in the universe. If we're only 5% weaker, there would be no deuterium. And that doesn't sound like much to us. Hey, I don't use deuterium much. But the sun does. And if the sun didn't have deuterium, we would be at absolute zero here. We wouldn't be here. But anyway, scenario. If the force were only 5% stronger, two protons would join together. That is, the force would be enough to overcome the repulsion of the positive charges in the protons. And so what we would call a diproton would be stable, and stars would burn explosively. And that would be bad news, too. You can imagine even much further distances than we are right here. That is to say, the strong force is tuned to about plus or minus 5% on the basis of just these considerations alone, without getting into the question of what slight changes might do to the character of certain elements or something of that sort that might be disastrous in other ways. Look at the weak force. If the weak force were a few percent weaker than it is now, then the events surrounding the Big Bang would have produced too little helium. With too little helium, there would be very few heavy elements in our universe today. You say, oh, well, I could do without some heavy elements. No lead to get into our water and food and supply and things of that sort. Yeah, but astrophysicists mean by heavy elements carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and everything on up. And if you didn't have any of those, you would be in trouble. So we're mostly hydrogen, I suppose, but it's all that carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, sulfur, etc., that really makes the whole system work. Even if that weren't a problem, the heavy elements would remain trapped inside stars, and there'd be no planets and no people. A few percent stronger, you get kind of the opposite problem here on the one. There'd be too much helium from the Big Bang, too many heavy elements, but you'd have the same problem on the other direction, that the heavy elements would remain trapped in stars, and so there wouldn't be any planets or people out here. So the weak force is tuned to a few percent. Electromagnetic force. The number of positive and negative charges in the universe appear to be almost exactly equal to better than one part in 10 to the 40th power. Now, the interesting thing about that is the major carriers of the positive and negative charge in our universe are two very different sized particles. The proton is over 1,000 times heavier than the electron is. And so as the universe was cooling off from the Big Bang, they froze out, so to speak. That is, the available energy in the universe per particle got down below the threshold to make pair production of protons and antiprotons at about 1,000 times the temperature of what it was when you get down when electrons would do the same thing. And yet you still have this match in the two to this size. You can, of course, hypothesize that they're exactly the same number of positive and negative charges in the universe, but nobody knows of any reason why that should be so. And yet, if it were not for this equality, electromagnetism would dominate gravity. The reason why gravity, as weak as it is, can be the major force controlling the motion of planets around stars and stars around the center of their galaxy and that sort of thing is because the electromagnetic force effectively cancels out. But if it weren't for this, there would be no galaxies or stars or planets. Electromagnetism is tuned to one part in 10 to the 40th power. Gravity. In order to have a stable universe, a universe that will last long enough to form galaxies and stars and planets, you have to have a very close balance between the force of gravity and the cosmic expansion that we see going on. If you go back to the earliest time that we know how to do calculations from, we think, the so-called Planck time, about 10 to the minus 43rd seconds after the Big Bang, if gravity were weaker at that point by one part in 10 to the 60th, the universe would expand too quickly and there would be no galaxies or stars formed. And yet if gravity were stronger by one part in 10 to the 60th at that point, the universe would have collapsed back on itself without forming galaxies or stars. And so gravity is fine-tuned in our universe to one part in 10 to the 60th power. So what does this tell us about fine-tuning? Well, we combine these cases. We get fine-tuning of essentially one part in 10 to the 100th power. That is a very striking thing. If you came into a room and saw down in the, say, came into this room and saw down here on the podium that a pencil was balanced on its point, you'd be surprised. If you walked down there, it was still balanced on its point, you'd be surprised. If you looked at, picked it up and saw that there wasn't any hole it was stuck in, you would certainly be surprised. If you walked down here and you saw 50,000 pencils balanced on their points down here, you would certainly be surprised. And yet, that hardly gives you any taste of what we're really looking at right here. How big is 10 to the 100th power? Well, I used to give a picture of how big 10 to the 23rd power was by suggesting that 10 to the 23rd power would be something like a piling sand a mile deep on all the land surfaces on Earth. That would be about 10 to the 23rd power. And to fine-tune something to one part in that would be, by chance anyway, would be something like imagining that one of those grains of sand is black and the rest are brown, and you have to blindfolded go find the black one by random processes. That's 10 to the 23rd. That's a small number. 10 to the 100 is a big number. The current estimate, which has been around for quite a few years, is that there are probably 10 to the 80 elementary particles in our universe. It's a little tricky to make an estimate on. We're not sure how big the universe is. and we're not sure we got all the elementary particles identified, but let's hang with that for a moment anyway. And that means all the electrons, protons, etc., in the universe, about 10 to the 80. So you would need about 10 to the 20th power universes to get 10 to the 100th particle. Now, 10 to the 23rd is the sand piled a mile deep on all the land area of the Earth. 10 to the 20th would be something like sand piled a mile deep on the state of California. So you need that many universes with 10 to the 80 elementary particles in them to get something, to get a 1 in 10 to the 100th likelihood. Well, for the cases we've examined, fine-tuning the universe for about 1 part in 10 to the 100th, we examined 4 cases. Ross and the Creator and the Cosmos list 22 more items besides these 4. None of them quite as big as the 10 to the 60 and 10 to the 40, but some of them still pretty big. You're multiplying all these things together, and so you're adding the superscript, adding the powers of 10. The universe looks designed. No, maybe it's not designed. Maybe it's just a lucky chance. Well, I wouldn't want to bet much of anything at a casino at 1 chance in 10 to the 100. But a person might say, well, maybe there are a lot of universes. Do we really have any evidence for another 10 to the 100th power universes to make this likely by chance? To make this likely by chance, you're going to need to get up to the order of 1. And so you need about 10 to the 100th power universes to have a likelihood that one of them will be like this. That really undercuts rather badly what's called the anthropic principle, that explanation of the anthropic principle, that says, well, if these things weren't this well-balanced, we wouldn't be here. And since we're here, it means we're in a universe that's well-balanced. Yeah, but I would hate to defend that particular thing by any kind of scientific methodology. For one thing, we don't know of any other universes. And so you're basically multiplying universes to avoid what would otherwise appear to be a natural conclusion from the data. You can do that to avoid any data. That's not science anymore. Science is attempting, I would trust, to make a explanation, to make a movement to the best explanation that fits the data. You heard a couple of things about Occam's razor there in that little clip we did of contact, but that shows up 2 or 3 times earlier in the film and is used rather ironically in the film because that's what Ellie is saying to her friend there, the evangelist or whatever you want to call them, and she's saying, basically, I don't want an explanation that's more complicated than necessary. But Occam had one proviso on that. Don't admit explanations more complicated than necessary to fit the data. Once you start fiddling with explaining away the data, putting a spin on it so the data doesn't matter, you are asking for trouble. You are asking that the universe step on you one day because you are ignoring what it's really like. When I was in grad school, Fred Hoyle was very well known as one of the 3 proponents of the steady-state theory of the universe. He was a very adamant atheist at that time, and something happened to him since then. He has now become some kind of a theist. And one of the things that first shook him was studying the energy levels in nuclei and finding out that if you messed around a little bit with the energy level in oxygen and the energy level in carbon, you would have a universe that would have virtually no carbon in it. And then as he began to investigate further and think about the complexity of living things and that sort of thing, he finally came up with this kind of a statement. A super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as with chemistry and biology. I'm not sure I would have used that verb, but but I think what we're looking at here is evidence that there is something that looks very much like design in nature. Well, we looked a little bit at the inanimate universe and suggested there's a message there. There's a message of very high improbability. I don't think anybody would have guessed 20 years ago that, they've all agreed that the universe is such a universe that will support life. Who can miss that? Okay. But They've been amazed at how much it's sitting on a knife edge. But the same thing is true of life. Living things are by far the most complex objects that we've found in our universe. Remember Sagan's remark about the E. coli bacterium. Information content, 10 to the 12th power bits. 100 million pages in Encyclopedia Britannica. Humans have trillions of cells. Up from a few billion when I was in school. But I presume the number is more accurate now. Each of which is considerably more complex than an E. coli cell. Hoyle moved over to his theistic position when he and his associate, Chandra Wickramasinghe, were trying to study the origin of life and kept running into what seemed to him to be life is too complicated to make sense given the size and age of our universe. Here's a remark. I don't know if he ever printed this one, but he said it verbally, and it was written down by one of the reporters from Nature magazine. The chance that higher life forms might have emerged by chance is comparable with the chance that a tornado sweeping through a junkyard might assemble a Boeing 747 from the materials therein. We come back to a theme we were looking at earlier when we were trying to recognize an extraterrestrial message. You remember Sagan said, ought to have strong signal. Well, this message regarding living things is a strong signal. It's seen in all living things. It ought to be decisive that it's not something that happened by chance. Well, the information content of living things, of even pretty simple living things, is beyond the probabilistic resources of the universe, as Bill Dembski says. Bill's work just came out from Cambridge University Press this past fall. It's very interesting to look at in this regard. It's called The Design Inference, William Dembski, and it's looking at the question of constructing a philosophically rigorous argument from design, and then looking to see what we have in our universe and what that has to tell us. The whole message to build an E. coli bacterium is about 100 million pages. But to build a Vagan's transporter in the contact was only 50,000 pages. A highly intelligent civilization has sent the one signal. I suggest maybe some highly intelligent individual or something of that sort has sent the other signal. Religion of Carl Sagan, what can we say in conclusion? If he was really open to the universe, if he really was willing to consider the supernatural, why didn't Sagan respond to this sort of evidence? Why did he draw back from the precipice of theism? How do you answer something like that? I can't. I'm not inside his head. But you're inside your head. How do you answer something like that? Okay.